At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
The trial of Ashley Benefield going to be wrapping up. It may already be wrapped up by the time you hear this, as we are now into verdict watch as of Tuesday afternoon. But we're going to first talk about some of the defense witnesses that testified in the trial before closing statements took place. Defense witnesses took the stand at that trial of Benefield, 32-year-old former professional ballerina accused of murdering her husband, Doug, in 2020. Benefield's defense, led by Anthony Neal Taylor, it's really soon to portray her as a frightened wife who acted in self-defense against an abusive husband. Benefield herself testified last Friday, admitting to killing Doug, but claiming it was in self-defense after he allegedly became physically abusive. On Monday, Taylor called several witnesses to support this defense. The first to testify was Bruce Ferris, a mental health professional specializing in domestic and family issues. Taylor asked Ferris to determine whether Ashley's alleged behavior fit the definition of a domestic abuse victim. Ferris affirmed that they did, citing actions such as acting differential and subservient during joint therapy sessions, but decisively different in individual sessions, being exposed to threats, intimidation, holding down, humiliating, cursing. They are, again, techniques of compliance, not wanting to poke the bear, Ferris explained. They don't want anyone to know, and they don't want their abuser to be angry by disclosing.
Describe, Force, what the term coercive control means in a domestic violence relationship.
So coercive control, acts of aggression, assault, threats to harm, punish, frighten the victims. And that fits in with creating fear, and it fits in with this whole continuum of power and control, a pattern that is developed to control the victim.
Offenders always behave violently, or does the abusive behavior happen in cycles?
They don't always act violently in what we, common term of a battery or an assault. It can be accomplished just by threats and fear. And in terms of a cycle, there can be a violent or emotionally abusive state, and then a honeymoon sort of state, and then it cycles back. In the field, we talk of a model of kind of like rain and sunshine.
And, all right, and let me ask you, Mr. Ferris, does the victim always appear to be afraid or act like they are afraid of the offender?
Definitely not. Oftentimes, the motivation is to hide the abuse from friends, family, law. There's lots of repercussions if it's disclosed. One could be fear that the oppressor, the abuser, the husband, the boyfriend, the wife, whoever is the abuser, will harm them. So they're very scared. The other is they might not even understand that they're victims of domestic violence. Quite often when I get clients, people don't know those definitions.
How common is it, Mr. Ferris, for a victim of domestic violence to smile and act happy in the company of the abuser?
Very much so, and also in terms of even in public or with family.
Why?
Because they're afraid. They found this least resistance. They're trying to not poke the bear, as we'll say, or we've all heard the term walking on eggshells. They're trying to avoid aggression by their partner because they've grown to believe that there's a threat here.
So would that be, could we characterize that as a... an appeasement?
Totally appeasement. It's something I see quite often.
Next on the stand was Vincent. Oh, this is a fun one.
Vizicaro.
Vizicaro. Oh, it looks more complex.
It does. There's duplicate letters in there, but really it's Vizicaro.
It is Vizicaro, isn't it? Oh, yeah.
Isn't that weird?
I've never seen that spelled out. Yeah. And Sarasota and Lakewood Ranch-based realtor Doug had previously contacted Vizicaro about purchasing a home in Lakewood Ranch near where Ashley lived. Judge Matt White initially ruled Vizicaro's evidence, emails between him and Doug, as hearsay and temporarily dismissed them. However, after deliberation, White overturned this decision, allowing Vizicaro to testify. Vizicaro revealed that Doug wanted to buy a house directly behind Ashley's while they were separated, suggesting a potential motive for control.
That house, is it directly behind the house in front of it with a red dot on it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. Do you know, Mr. Vizicaro, who was living in the house with the red dot at 11331 White Rock Terrace?
No, I don't.
And do you know whether or not, if I may, you know whether or not you don't know who was living in this house?
No.
This is the house that Mr. Benefield was interested in purchasing?
Correct.
Do you know whether or not Mr. John Sant lived in that house?
I don't know.
Give me just a moment, Your Honor. I don't believe I have anything further.
I'm trying to figure out where he was going with that.
I think that what he was trying to do was show that apparently Benefield lived in one of these other houses that was nearby. I think that's what I was.
She lived in the one with the red. I think it was the red dot. And then Doug was trying to buy the house behind her.
Yeah, I think that's what the point was. But he didn't ever get the witness to say that.
No, and I'm curious as to what difference it makes who lives next to those homes. Because I think that's what he was trying to point out. Like, do you know who lives at this other one?
Well, I was, yeah, maybe to kind of inch him closer to the answer. I don't know. That was just kind of bizarre.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Like, no, I don't. I know I don't know who lives there. Like, you would think you're going to know. you need to have your witnesses ready if they're for you.
You'd think.
You would think. That's because even like Benefield was looking confused there. I have to say, it's very interesting how she's gone from looking, you know, very kind of, you know, posh and vogue. What do you even say? I don't even like, she looked good, very well dressed. And now she looks like a Amish woman that might have done a barn raising just the other day.
Well, it's an interesting contrast between her and Karen Reed, who looked very polished every single day, very professional. You know, they're obviously two different people. It's two different cases, two different lifestyles, but just a interesting contrast. You know, was there any coaching behind the scenes of how you should look, how you should dress? It's just interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is a thing. I mean, you always kind of, that's part of it. I just find the contrast like jarring. And I'm wondering, you know, if anybody who has seen her previously, because it's not like you don't have to have any knowledge of a case to be on a jury. You just really can't, you know, have much of an opinion, but you can know it existed. You can know see a picture of the of her and go, yeah, I know she's from that case. And if they saw the other pictures prior to this, I'd be kind of shocked when I walked into that room and saw that. That to me, honestly, would be kind of like, oh, this is a, it's like, it's an immediate manipulation move. And I'm not saying everybody doesn't do it. A lot of people do. There's nothing wrong with it if you're trying to you know, prove your innocence to a jury. But it was jarring.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. Dr. Jason Quintal, a counselor who worked with both Doug and Ashley, followed Vizicaro. Quinty shared his professional conclusions about Doug, stating that Ashley expressed fear towards him and that Doug maintained an alpha male persona. Doug occurred as somebody who was domineering, super confronting, Quantel testified. The testimony later shifted focus to the shooting itself. Michael Hagg, a forensic shooting reconstructionist expert, discussed the bullet trajectories. According to Hagg, two bullets struck Doug from a different angle, and other objects in the room were also hit by bullets, indicating that Ashley moved during the shooting. There's not a physical possibility for the firearm to have been stationary between just those two shots, Hagg said. Closing arguments for both sides have taken place, and we will talk about those tomorrow and when we maybe have a verdict when this all comes in.
I'm just wavering still. It's such a weird thing. If she was abused, if he was a danger to her, I can see it. I feel it. Like, the guy is trying to get a house right behind her. I mean, talk about control. But yet, if they have a child together, maybe he was thinking, well, this would just be an easier way as the child gets older for the kid to not have to be shuttled to a different school district and all these things. So I don't know.
I think you have just a toxic brew of two toxic people. I think he probably was very controlling. Doesn't sound like he was a physical abuser. But we heard about that, like, he kicked his ex-wife or something. But she said, Benefield said, never was physical until that night. But that doesn't mean he's not a horrific mental abuser, which sounds like, right, he was very manipulative, very controlling, and that can sometimes be far worse in terms of the lasting effects. So I think he probably was some percentage of that. And I think she was a master manipulator and really, you know, had ideas in what she wanted to have happen. And the two were just, you know, they're going not to help each other grow and be a good couple. It's just, what do I individually want and how can I control you and how can you control me? And I think it ended in this weird, horrible thing. I don't know that this was premeditated, but I do question how in danger she was and how much of the battered syndrome is going on here. We obviously watched it on TV or on YouTube or whatever. And, you know, it's hard to see close up on a face, but the consensus in that courtroom is that there was no actual tears during that episode.
I'm going to look this up. Bear with me a second. No tears, crier. Is that a thing when crying? No tears when crying. Let me look and see if that's an actual thing. Let's see.
I mean,
why can't I cry? Your inability to shed tears may be medical or emotional. Some certain medications, depression.
Mm-hmm. Well,
dry eyes.
There's a possibility, but we also had the same judgment on Alec Murdaugh when he did not cry while he was having his snot fit.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm just saying, I mean, I don't know. I do not know. I think we're going to have a hung jury. But I can see both sides have some pretty solid arguments, especially when you look at the timeline of manipulation on her part and not letting him see the kid. But there's no order, you know, for anything for her to be able to do that. So I don't know. I mean, either the system extremely failed her, which I can see, because our system is not good in this department. Or maybe it's a mix of both. I don't know. Or it's all manipulation and it just never went her way. And this was, she just acted out. I don't know. I really don't know. Those are like kind of all the scenarios that run through my mind. And yeah, that's why they're going to have a hung jury.
I tell you from experience, my dad was just a horrific mental abuser. Mm-hmm. And I never saw him lay his hands on my mom until the time that she was leaving, which is what this therapist in this case talked about.
Yeah.
but he was a horrible creature. And I really, at some point, I could have seen my mom pull this on him.
Yeah.
She never did, mm-hmm. but she could have. At any given point, to protect the kids or to protect herself, if she had had a gun nearby, she might have shot him and killed him. So for me, when I see this case, I look at it and go, yeah, I can totally believe, you know, years and years and years, even though they weren't together for that long.
Yeah.
Overwhelming fear of my life is in danger and now I've got kids and I have to protect them. I can see it.
I can too. That's the thing. I can see it both ways. I think if there wasn't this track record of preceding Doug's death, though, of her really going to extreme lengths to not let him see the kid and, you know, despite there being no, you know, evidence other than her accusations against him, that just seemed like a really, you know, it looked on the surface, if you didn't know what was going on, it looks a lot like someone's trying to just push one of the parents out, you know, and you hope that they're doing it the right way, if it's truly a threat. And maybe that's what, again, maybe there's your choose your own adventure. Maybe that is why, you know. Or it's, I just really want all this control. I think they both were controlling people.
Yeah, I think so.
So I've covered everything so no one can be mad at me.
Well, somebody's going to be mad at you no matter what.
I mean, I've expressed every scenario that I can think of. You know, it's, I just don't know. That's the thing. And I don't know that anyone really does know other than her.
I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, we shall find out.
Want to listen ad-free? Want advanced access to all of our interviews before anyone else?
Become a True Crime Today Premium Plus subscriber on Apple Podcasts.
You get every episode commercial-free,
so you can binge on true crime
until you can binge no more.
Search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts now, or go to our podcast page and sign up now.
More of the Hidden Killers podcast next.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. No purchase necessary. See rules at playmcd.com for full details and amoe.playmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.